Hello.
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 For now.
On monotonic to
you for now.
On monotonic
to you
for now.
On monotonic
to you
for
now.
On monotonic
to you for now. Sort of an inaugural episode
of
the rebirth of Reading for Now. If you've been tuning in, if you've been following along, we've been working through books, a chapter at a time, and I wanted to stay a little bit more flexible so I can really live up to the title, Reading for Now, and really kind of pivot and shift towards the topics of today, a little bit more of a responsive manner. So with that being said, we are on week one of a two-week syllabus on Venezuela, more specifically just sort of the history of American intervention in Venezuela. And today, this episode is called A Present History, which we're kind of taking a look at how the, you know, abduction of Venezuela's president, Maduro, is sort of a continuation in a long line of this style of American intervention in South America. And so this week we're learning a little bit about narco-terrorism, the narco-terrorist elite, from Prospect Magazine online. The article is by Maureen Tachik. And then our second article is Abduction in Caracas from New Left Review by Ali Tariq. So the process is that I have these articles in front of me. Some sections of the articles have been sort of cut for time, and I'll be summarizing them kind of just more vocally to you. These articles will be linked on Substack, which is where there will also be in the audio from this episode and a transcription, hopefully, given that I figure out how to do that. That's not an incredibly time-exhaustive manner. But with that being said, we're just going to jump right in. And we're starting today with Narco-Terrorist Elite by Maureen Tachik. And this article tells, you know, the story of Latin American intervention, of American intervention in South America, kind of through the lens of its, you know, most diehard apologist, which is Marco Rubio, and his kind of storied past when it actually comes to large-scale drug trafficking. So for the sake of time, I'm sort of going to summarize Marco Rubio's kind of personal timeline when it comes to Miami drug deals. So Marco Rubio's brother-in-law, Orlando Cecilia, immigrates from Cuba to Miami around the time when Mark is born. And about a decade later, his brother-in-law will begin to work for the Tabre family. And in Miami, sort of an open kept secret that this family conducts major drug deals. If you watch the show Tiger King, and stayed long enough to get to the part where they were kind of smuggling massive amounts of drugs through exotic snakes, this is that family. Orlando's busted when Marco Rubio's around 16 years old, as sort of the front man for the Tabre family. And again, you know, the fact that this family was responsible, had many, business fronts, and was responsible for a large sum of the cocaine trafficking in Miami. What was not so known was that the sort of patriarch of the family, Guillermo Tabre, was a DEA informant. And this wasn't found out until his trial, which came at the, you know, the result of the massive sting operation in Miami. At his trial, his CIA handler comes to testify, and this is allegedly at the direct order of Mr. George Bush Sr. Guillermo Tabre only ends up serving a couple months in a minimum security prison on an Air Force base before he's released. Sorry, I'm working between two sets of notes. But yeah, he gets out of prison, pretty loose charge considering, you know, the weight of his crimes. And then flashing forward in Marco's life, he's now an adult and he's running for city commissioner in Miami. And his campaign is pretty generously supported by this guy, Alan Mendelson, who's an ophthalmologist in Miami and also kind of known as quite a political fixer. But in 2001, a very Miami-esque crime happens. A mid-sized boat gets seized by the Coast Guard, and they find 12 tons of cocaine on that boat, along with a very extensive paper trail connecting the ringleader of a Miami-based Ponzi scheme laundering cartel money through that same guy, Alan Mendelsohn's campaign political action committees and various foundations. So kind of sort of from the beginning of Marco Rubio's political career, it is, you know, heavily funded by people who are laundering large sums of cocaine money. But, you know, this kind of goes under the radar, and Marco Rubio's connections to large-scale drug trafficking isn't really found out until around 2011 when Univision is publishing a story, and Marco Rubio and his team attempt to kill the story and kind of waged war on the network. So this is something that obviously Marco Rubio does not want to talk about. But that doesn't really stop Marian Kochek, and we're just Tachik, and we're just gonna begin reading now. So today, Marco Rubio is the Trump administration's most formidable liar. When Pam Bondi or Pete Hegseth or Caroline Levitt or Stephen Miller refers to an anti-genocide protester or day laborer or sandwich hurler or fisherman clinging in the wreckage of a fishing boat that has been struck by a hellfire missile as a terrorist, they come off as pathological. But Rubio's approval ratings are the highest in the Republican Party, even if he is the architect of what is arguably Trump's most cynical policy, the scheme to appoint drug cartel bosses and their cronies atop of governments in every Latin American country in the name of fighting drug cartels. In September, Rubio hailed Ecuadorian President Daniel Noboa, who leads a country whose homicide rate risen eightfold since 2016, as an incredibly willing partner who has done more in the last couple years to take the fight to these narco-terrorists and these threats to the security and stability of Ecuador than any other previous administration. Just 5 months earlier, a damning investigation revealed that Noba's family's fruit business had trafficked 700 kilos of cocaine to Europe in banana crates between 2020 and 2022. Rubio has tirelessly promoted the cause of convicted, alas, just pardoned drug trafficker Juan Orlando Hernandez in 2018. Rubio personally and publicly commended Hernandez, the then president of Honduras, for combating drug traffickers and supporting Israel, just 7 months before his brother was indicted for trafficking 158 tons of cocaine in container stamp TH for Tony Hernandez. Rubio has raved about his crime-fighting efforts of Salvadorian and Argentine junior strongmen Nayib Bukele and Javier Milei, in spite of the former's documented alliance with MS-13 and various Miami cocaine trafficking scandals that enveloped his libertarian political party last fall, as well as both leaders' slavish devotion to the drug cartel's single favorite mode of money laundering. Rubio has been one of the Beltway's biggest backers of newly elected Chilean President Jose Antonio Kast, the son of a literal Nazi war criminal who has spent his entire political career lionizing, whitewashing, and promising a restoration of the brutal reign of Augusto Pinochet, who personally ordered the Chilean army to build a cocaine laboratory, consolidated narcotics trades inside his terrifying secret police, and then allegedly disappeared key conspirators like his secret police chemist, Eugenio Barrios. And just a quick pause here. When Tachik refers to the favorite means of money laundering, she's talking about the crypto coin Tether. It's a stable coin, which an investigation literally showed that it's sold cheaper in Mexico to aid large-scale drug transactions. And then Jose Antonio Kast, who's this Chilean presidential elect, some things about him is that one brother of his was trained personally by Milton Friedman as a sort of neoliberal economic experiment in Chile. And his other brother is linked to the personal massacres of peasants under Pinochet. Rubio met with Jose Antonio cast, it was him and 20 U.S. business executives with a lot to gain with a favorable person in office. So, and for at least a decade, Rubio has allotted, strategized with, and viciously condemned the multitude of criminal investigations into former Colombian President Álvaro Uribe, whom some describe as a sort of Kissingerian figure and to the former Florida senator. A 1991 Pentagon analysis described Uribe, whom Rubio depicts as a kind of paradigmatic drug warrior, as one of the hundred most important Colombian narco terrorists, a close friend of Pablo Escobar and a political figure dedicated to the collaboration with the Medellin cartel at high government levels. That brings us to Rubio's current campaign of state-sponsored terrorism against Venezuela and fishermen emanating from there, on the pretext that Nicolas Maduro runs something called the Cartel of the Suns, which has flooded the United States with cheap cocaine. The case is that anything but a fairy tale laid out in 2020 indictment, whose insanity I hope to explore soon, but its flimsiness is also underscored by puny vessels SOCOM has chosen to drone strike into oblivion. Last week, Berkeley professor emeritus Peter Dale Scott wrote a letter to the New York Times disputing that the newspaper's characterization of a remarkable dissonance between Trump's simultaneous massacres and substance traffickers and pardoning of a convicted trafficker of more than 400 tons of cocaine. They're talking about the former Honduran president there. Actually, he pointed out the contradiction was remarkably on. I am actually really, really struggling to speak today. We're gonna see how this goes. Might stop early if I just like find myself a little tongue-tied. Actually, he pointed out the contradiction was markedly unremarkable. The ill-conceived and deliberately misnamed war on drugs has been a cover for contradictory CIA involvement with drug traffickers for decades. This is especially true in Venezuela, Scott noted. Customs services investigating probing a 998-pound cocaine seizure in the country in 1990 discovered the agency had been operating a joint venture with top military generals to traffic cocaine as a purported means of infiltrating Colombian cartels. The venture has been nicknamed Cartel de los Soles, and the Times itself reported that it successfully smuggled tons of cocaine in the United States with virtually no accountability until Hugo Chavez imprisoned the general who had spearheaded the cartel and expelled the DEA from Venezuela, at which point it became fashionable to finance industrial sabotage, military coups, and ultimately terror attack projects under the premise that it was a narco state. As historian Greg Grandin pointed out in a series of recent podcast appearances, whereas in many realms, the scale and the breadth of the Trump administration plunge into mafia rule is truly unprecedented, in Latin America is more a continuation of policy that dates back at least a century. Behind every single horror that Donald Trump represents exists a long train of U.S. presidents that have first put in the policies that make what Trump does today possible, Grandin said. Few Americans learn this lesson the hard way at such a tender age as Marco Rubio. The labyrinth scandal known as the Iran-Contra began to unravel in 1986 when the Nicaraguan Air Force lobbed a missile at suspicious Fairchild cargo plane. As the fuselage packed full of grenade launchers, AK-47s, and ammunition, two pilots and a radio crewman plunged to Earth, a lone white guy from Wisconsin, who died just 2 weeks ago, parachuted down intact and quickly admitted he worked for a CIA project with a guy named Max Gomez. Gomez turned out to be Felix Rodriguez, one of Mario Tabre's dad's Guillermo's old comrades from the Movimiento de Recuperación Revolucionaria, or MRR. The crew of anti-communist revolutionaries was led by physician Manuel Artem, who carried out the Bay of Pigs invasion and various subsequent terror attacks and sabotage operations in Cuba for years after. A quick aside, the Iran-Contra, if anyone needs a sort of refresher, is when the U.S., trafficked weapons to Iran, and the hope was that the sales were going to go towards the anti-Sandinista groups, like the MRR. Reagan initially defended it by claiming that they were going to trade those guns for hostages held by Hezbollah in Lebanon. This kind of was discovered to not be the case. Bay of Pigs is a failed military operation between the anti-Castro Cuban government Revolutionary Front and the U.S. And the man, Manuel Artime, kind of at the helm of that, prior to working with the CIA, he was actually a Castro guerrilla army captain. He then fled to Mexico, where he began communication with Watergate convict Bernard Baker. Kind of his leaving of Cuba and out of the guerrilla army to Mexico to work with the CIA. That the details of that are a little messier. The plane turned out to have belonged to Barry Seal, a special forces pilot turned prolific cocaine trafficker who had just been murdered by cartel hitmen. Following a convention for smuggling quaaludes, Seal had let the CIA install hidden cameras on a plane and set out a covert sting operation to frame Nicaragua's Sandinista government. For drug trafficking by capturing images of Pablo Escobar stuffing cocaine into duffel bags in Managua alongside a titular top aide to the Sandinista general, which thereupon became the basis of the Reagan administration's renewed appeal for funds to finance regime change in the Central American country. I know every American parent concerned with the drug problem will be outraged to learn that a top Nicaraguan government official are so deeply involved in drug trafficking, President Reagan said in a 1986 televised speech. There seems to be no crime to which the Sandinistas will not stoop. But the Sandinista official turned out to be a former U.S. embassy staffer. The SEAL seemed to, a longtime CIA asset who appears to have participated in the Bay of Pigs and was even photographed in 1963 with the same Felix Rodriguez, who would later become his agency handler. Rodriguez was known for his soft touch. Three officials involved in the investigation of the gruesome 1985 cartel execution of Kiki Camarena, a Mexico-based DEA agent, have repeatedly claimed Rodriguez ordered the hit after the young agent uncovered evidence revealing the extent of the agency's collaboration with the Mexican cartels. An accusation the Miami stalwart, who currently stars in a series of YouTube shorts and recently hosted former Colombian President Uribe for a Bay of Pigs anniversary event, denies. I did watch some of these reels. YouTube shorts, sorry. I'm sure they were also posted on reels. It's pretty crazy. He's just kind of like sitting in an office chair and is like, yeah, so I did this and I did this and this and this. Yeah. The genesis of the MRR's conquest of the Latin American underworld dates back to at least 1964, when the CIA reportedly got hold of pornographic photos of Manuel Artime's lesbian wife, who his bosses learned had been a mistress to both the Fulgencio Batista and former Venezuelan dictator Marcos Perez Jimenez. Around the same time, the MRR accidentally killed three Spanish sailors off the coast of Cuba. To contain the PR fallout, Artime was advised to spend more time in Managua, where the right-wing dictatorship of Luis Somoza would nurture his projects more unreservedly. But Artime was soon in the news for a different scandal. A young Cuban immigrant from New Jersey whose husband had been recruited to one of his Central American training camps had received an anonymous letter advising her that Artime had hired assassins to murder her husband because he did not approve of the immoral activities in the camps, among them the smuggling of liquor, which took place on a boat of Artime in collusion with an official of the Nicaraguan government. Costa Rican customs officials around the same time discovered an abandoned plane full of tens of thousands of dollars worth of contraband whiskey and women's clothing in the jungle near what appeared to be an unauthorized guerrilla camp. An FBI informant advised that different Cuban exile leaders continued to claim that Artime and the MMR were making a living off the Cuban revolutionary activities, were engaged in smuggling instead of anti-communist warfare, and were misappropriating funds designed for commando and infiltration activities. It was claimed that Artime's men returned from Central America very disenchanted or with large sums of money earned through illegal activity. Guillermo Tabre served as MMR's paymaster during these years, and there would be very little ambiguity which camp he fell into. In 1970, the Bureau of Narcotics and Dangerous Drugs carried out a blitzkrieg seven-city drug bust, which they called the largest roundup of major drug traffickers in recorded history, noting in a press conference that none of the 150 men arrested was a known member of organized crime, but declining to mention that most, as many as 70% by one estimate, belonged to our time's Bay of Pigs veteran organization. Just 2 years later, the state attorney's office opened an investigation into Tabre's jewelry shop after discovering that he'd given cufflinks to a municipal judge who had reduced the sentences for two young women convicted of loitering and sold various items to the chief of police. The following year, our times recruited a 23-year-old accounting whiz named Ramon Emilian Rodriguez, who would rise up to become the top accountant to the Mendelian cartel and a close confidant of the Panamanian dictator Manuel Noriega, to begin laundering money into Nicaraguan banks to assist the legal defense funds of four Bay of Pigs alumni who had participated in the Watergate burglary. In 1972, the CIA offered a detail to its team and its own covert operations specialists to assist the Bureau at keeping an eye on its old assets while ensuring that drug investigations did not conflict with national security concerns. The BNDD put together a sophisticated database called the Bureau of Narcotics Covert Intelligence Network, later renamed DECON, when the Bureau was absorbed into the DEA, and hired Tabre as its first big recruit to flesh out its intelligence network. The CIA paid Tabre $1,400 a month during the 1970s for intel on his rival drug traffickers. The scheme worked exactly as intended. Drug traffickers who were allied with the CIA's ideological objectives were protected, assisted, recruited as assets, while drug traffickers who bribed or cooperated with leftists, crossed the agency, or outlived their usefulness were set up for prosecution or discarded. Prosecutions were a low priority, and the DECON team reportedly contributed no admissible evidence whatsoever to DEA drug prosecutions in the 1970s, as the former DEA official Dennis Dale lamented in 1986. In my 30 years of experience with the DEA and related agencies, the main objectives of my investigation almost invariably turned out to be CIA workers. If the CIA's defense, those drug revenues financed terrorist attacks, assassinations, and infiltrations that arguably intensified the atmosphere of fear, distrust, and hopelessness that eased the challenge of repressing the left. In 1975, Bay of Pigs veterans were involved in nearly half of the terrorist attacks that took place, though they chose their battles wisely. During the Watergate investigation, our time testified that CIA agent turned Nixon operative E. Howard Hunt had recruited him to assassinate Panamanian populist Omar Torrijos because the Nixon administration was highly concerned with the flow of narcotics into the United States was being filtered through Panama, according to a report written by a private investigator confidant of the Cuban exile leader, who died suddenly in the weeks before he was slated to testify before the House Subcommittee on Assassinations. Twin Operations Condor set the tone of the era, a clandestine continental program officially launched in 1975 by Augusto Pinochet and the Argentine junta, and only revealed 2 decades later by the discovery of a top-secret Paraguayan terror archive. A junta is like a military government that gets put in when there's a coup, like immediately after a coup. Some scholars now argue, based on more recently discovered documents, that Condor's true genesis was the 1967 operation overseen by the ubiquitous Felix Rodriguez and other MRR veteran to hunt down and execute Che Guevara. The idea is that the frontiers don't terminate with the individual geography of each state, but that it is necessary to defend Western politics wherever necessary, explained the Argentine intelligence officer quoted in the aforementioned Berkeley Emeritus Professor Scott's canonical survey of the Iran-Contra era. It is therefore necessary to act against those who could become a second Cuba, to collaborate with the United States directly and indirectly. A note on Operation Condor, because it is something that kind of comes up again throughout this article and also our next. Operation Condor was financed by the U.S., but it was a campaign of political repression led by Pinochet and 50 intelligence officers from the Southern Cone of South America. And in all the operations kind of led by this right-wing operation, some 60,000 people are estimated to have been murdered. And these would all have been, communists or people they deemed as sympathizers to a communist cause. Around the same time and under the same name, an official collaboration of the American DEA, the Mexican Army, and the Mexican police eradicated thousands of acres of poppy and marijuana plants, devastating many small farmers and unleashing an epidemic of murder and grotesque violence that persists to this day. The scholar Adela Cedillo argues that the Mexican Operation Condor Mexican Operation Condor's real purpose was to eradicate the populace stuff by essentially criminalizing small-scale agriculture while reorganizing and centralizing the Mexican military to the benefit of a handful of dominant players. In other words, to serve a hidden agenda near identical to that of its namesake. When Marco Rubio maligns the efficacy of interdiction and other traditional law enforcement approaches to mitigating narco trafficking in favor of military operations, as he did in a recent speech on Trump's speedboat bombings, he is contradicting every empirical evaluation of drug war efficacy that exists. Yes, but he's also pining for a kind of Cold War era blanket license to commit dirty war in the name of some bigger goal. By maligns the inefficacy of interdiction, that means interdiction is just when you intercept objects before they receive their destination. And in that speech, essentially, Marco Rubio is saying that we don't do enough to deter. The interdiction doesn't deter people from trying to bring drugs in, and the deterrent would be sort of warningless execution by drone. That's kind of why he's pro. Quote, they're bringing back Operation Condor. An emerging market bond investor told me casually in October after the Trump administration pledged $40 billion to stabilize the Argentine peso, but warned that the money would vanish if Milei's government lost its majority in the country's midterm elections. And perhaps it never ended. Earlier this month, the longtime CIA agent Bob Cenci was indicted for conspiracy to commit narco-terrorism alongside a former high-ranking DEA official for laundering $750,000 and agreeing to procure grenade launchers and commercial drones capable of carrying 6 kilograms of C4 for a government informant posing as an agent of a Mexican cartel. The duo advised the informant to create the perception that they are moving fentanyl operations from Mexico to Colombia to divert attention from Mexico and towards the center-left government of Gustavo Petro. Perhaps notably, the scheme launched just weeks after November 2024 election. A memoir titled America at Night by CIA acquaintance of Sensei's named Larry Kolb describes the alleged money launderer as a cunning all-purpose fixer who was personally introduced to him by George H.W. Bush in 1985, and he reported directly to the then CIA director Bill Casey. Cenci was at the time deeply immersed in the Middle Eastern back channel elements of Iran-Contra, in which shadowy operatives and informal surrogates met clandestinely with officials of Hezbollah and Iran to negotiate secret ransoms for various hostages. But it was indicted for skimming funds from a cover job at Kuwait Airways, and according to the book Out for Revenge Ever Since. The former intelligence officer predicted to prospect that Cenci's current legal troubles would not last long because the Trump administration would find him useful, as previous administrations have found most Iran-Contra major players who made it out of the early 1990s alive. Which brings us back to the Tabre family, who in the 1970s belonged to a sprawling drug trafficking organization associated with Rolls-Royce driving hairdresser and MRR veteran Jose Madera Alvaro Cruz. When Cruz and a whole raft of the Tabre collaborators were busted in 1979, a group of related Bay of Pigs vets got involved with Operation Condor's first big success story of the 1980s, the cocaine coup in Bolivia, in which Nazi war criminal Klaus Barbie and the Israeli-trained Argentine PSYOP guru turned cocaine trafficker Alfredo Murillo Mingola, that's a mouthful, collaborated in the weeks following the election of a left-leaning presidential candidate to install one of the world's most unabashed narco-democracy. Narcocracy. That guy, Klaus Barbie, from Bolivia, was the head of the Gestapo in Leon, also known as the Butcher of Leon. And so the interesting that he worked alongside an Israeli-chained Argentine PSYOP guru turned cocaine trafficker, because again, this is 20 years after Eichmann is captured in Argentina. Like, it's pretty amazing the turnaround here that, like, a very notorious Nazi lead of a Gestapo branch actually ended up being trained. So as a right-wing military, Junta raced to release drug traffickers from prison and even open a cocaine factory that the country's preeminent cartel boss claimed was controlled by the DEA. The traffickers raced to collaborate with a new regime in a cycle that repeated itself in the following year with the sudden death of Torrijos and installation of the narco-friendly Manuel Noriega in Panama. But Nicaragua, where the Somoza family had been such accommodating host to anti-communist mercenaries throughout the Cold War, had been conquered by the Sandinistas in 1979, and the old MMR rank and file took it personally. To fight the Sandinistas, the CIA and the thriving drug traffickers bankrolled a confederation of anti-communist militias known as the Contras, with bases in El Salvador, Costa Rica, Guatemala, and Panama, who torched oil storage tanks, implanted magnetic mines in the ports, and bombed the Managua airport, all with the idea, as verbalized by one State Department official, of turning Nicaragua into the Albania of Latin America. Meanwhile, draconian crackdowns on users and substance entrepreneurs sent the prison population surging by 250% between 1975 and 1990, permanently traumatizing families and communities. Because Congress worked a little differently back then, it passed a series of 5 laws attempting to prevent the Reagan administration from using tax dollars to fund the Contras. The CIA's sprawling network of drug traffickers had already done so, but the tightening restrictions led to an intense off-the-books fundraising efforts. Tabre hosted fundraisers for the anti-communist struggle in Nicaragua at a social club he owned called Club Olimpo, and the Unification cult hosted anti-communist speaking tours with Contra leaders. And the Contras sought after traffickers with legal problems to offer to trade deep state lobbying services for cash and weapons. Manuel Artime's old protege, Milian Rodriguez, pitched in just under $10 million on behalf of the Mendelian cartel, delivered directly to Felix Rodriguez. We're kind of jumping over sort of more background information on Marco Rubio's brother-in-law. But we do meet Milian Rodriguez again, who, you know, donated $10 million on behalf of the Mendelian cartel. When the prosecutor from the Tabre family's case, we meet Milian Rodriguez again when he is called on to testify at the trial of Panama's Manuel Noriega by the prosecutor from the Tabre family's case. Manuel Noriega refused to self-extradite on narcotics trafficking charges, leading the Bush administration to invade the country and remove him from office. However, there were some hiccups when Milian Rodriguez testified that he had also sent some $10 million to the Nicaraguan Contras care. Felix Rodriguez in hopes of currying favor with the CIA. Later, Noriega claimed the CIA had paid him tens of millions of dollars for his participation in the dirty drug war. The agency could only find records it had paid him $330,000. But in general, the campaign to invade a titularly sovereign country so as to throw an erstwhile CIA puppet under the bus for the sins of the CIA, known as Operation Just Cause, was such a smashing success that such giants of Trump's foreign policy brain trust as Elliot Abrams and Ben McGurk have publicly pleaded with war-weary Americans to understand that it is Panama, not Iraq or Libya, that is their blueprint for regime change in Venezuela. That's the end of Article 1. So obviously, we're left with when they got Manuel Noriega, it was a 14-day offensive. They kind of treated it as this very, like, in-and-out operationalized procedure to, you know, bring someone and, you know, charge them. bring the leader of a sovereign nation and charge him in the United States on narcotics trafficking charges. And a blueprint it was. That's exactly what happened. And we're going to hear more about that directly in this next piece, Abduction in Caracas. And we're making good time. I'm really pleasantly surprised. I thought I was going to look at my phone and it was going to say 11:50. Anyway, this is from New Left Review, Abduction in Caracas by Tariq Ali. 2 decades before the U.S. kidnapped Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro this weekend, Hugo Chavez had already predicted the approach. Years ago, someone told me, they're going to end up accusing you of being a drug trafficker. You, personally, you, Chavez. Not just that the government supports it or permits it. No, no, no. They're going to try to apply the Noriega formula to you. They're looking for a way to associate Chavez directly with drug trafficking. And then anything goes against a drug trafficker president, right? On the morning of January 3rd, Trump tweeted a Happy New Year message. The U.S. had carried out a large-scale strike on Venezuela and its leader. President Maduro and his wife Celia had been captured and flown out of the country. Trump said more details would follow in a few hours' time. The details, however, were confused. Later that day, an old friend from Caracas rang to say that the secret negotiations had been taking place for some time between the regime and the Americans. The Americans want Maduro's head, which he refused to supply. According to the New York Times, he was offered transport to a well-cushioned retirement in Turkey, which he scorned, to his great credit. And though repeatedly offering to negotiate with Washington on questions of oil and U.S. drug imports, he was also rallying Venezuelans against Trump's military buildup in the Caribbean. The Trump administration evidently preferred negotiations with Delcy Rodriguez, the vice president, and others in Venezuela, where the two key ministers are Diosdado Cabello at the Interior Ministry and Vladimir Padrino at Defense. Both have the support in the army, some 100,000 strong, and Cabello also commands the popular militia forces, which are said to be larger still. As Trump reinforced his threatening armada over the past few months, Maduro government responded by securing sections of the population, by arming sections of the population. The question of who now governs Venezuela has therefore become crucial. The first answer came from Trump. We are going to run the country until such a time we can do a safe and proper judicious transition. But the Trump administration is caught in a cleft stick. Trump's MAGA base is not in favor of sending American troops to be killed in foreign countries. This is a central part of the campaign waged against the Democrats and the old GOP establishment over Afghanistan and Iraq. They do not want U.S. troops on the ground in Venezuela. At the same time, the hard-right Latino immigrant ultras represented by Rubio are unhappy. The Bolivarians are still in office in Caracas. There was talk at one point that Marco Rubio might be appointed de facto governor or consul to give orders to the Venezuelan government. Meanwhile, messages from Caracas have been mixed. The day after the capture of Maduro, Cabello declared, "This is an attack against Venezuela. We are in position. We call on our people to remain calm and to trust the leadership. Do not allow anyone to become discouraged or make the situation easier for the aggressive enemy." Rodriguez, confirmed by the Venezuelan Supreme Court as interim president for the next 3 months, went on state TV to call for Maduro's release. Trump attacked her in an interview with The Atlantic for not being sufficiently pliant, saying if she made promises that must now be kept, and threatening, if she doesn't do what's right, she is going to pay a very big price, probably bigger than Maduro. He went on, regime change, call it anything you want, is better than what you have right now. Can't get any worse. As Chavez warned, Trump and Rubio have been trying to fit up Maduro on narco-terrorism charges, the latest iteration of those invisible weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. Maduro is not the president of Venezuela, Rubio tweeted last summer, and his regime is not the legitimate government. Maduro is the head of the Cartel de los Soles, a narco-terror organization which has taken possession of the country, and he is under indictment for pushing drugs in the United States. The irony is that Delta Force, the U.S. state terrorist special forces team that abducted the Venezuelan president, is itself widely regarded as operating a drug trafficking network within the United States. the investigative journalist Seth Harps, the Fort Bragg cartel, drug trafficking and murder in the special forces, documents murder and narcotics trafficking committed in and around the U.S. installation outside of Fayetteville, North Carolina. Harps' book made it onto the New York Times bestseller lists, and reviewers have largely accepted its findings. So this criminal U.S. operation was carried out by its own drug cartel. There's no sense of shame here or anything like that. They just do it, assuming people will keep on taking this as long as they can point to a few successes. Another couple more details from Seth Harp's book that I think are, you know, just kind of drive this point home. While in Afghanistan, in particular, special forces operators would kind of seize control of whole poppy farms, of like heroin production in Afghanistan, under the guise of, you know, not allowing heroin to, riddle the people of Afghanistan and people in the United States. But they were strapping heroin to themselves and flying home with it, and selling like pure Afghani heroin to the people in Fayetteville. They would get thousands and thousands of dollars in cash from the U.S. government to carry out these kind of covert spy operations in these countries. And they would come home with that cash strapped to, like, taped to their body, for them to come home and then run, you know, pretty massive scale drug operation out of their base. Not to mention just the amount of drugs that these men are prescribed while doing these missions. They come home drug addled, to say the least, which has then caused this entire town to become drug addled as well. It's a really harrowing read, and I think everyone should read it. We now have Attorney General Pam Bondi tweeting the so-called indictments, which have a touch of insanity about them. This is her tweet. Nicolas Maduro and his wife Cecilia Flores have been indicted in the Southern District of New York. Nicolas Maduro has been charged with narco-terrorism conspiracy, cocaine importation conspiracy, possession of machine guns and destructive devices, and conspiracy to possess machine guns and destructive devices against the United States. Many have pointed out, as Chavez himself noted, that this is the Noriega script. But there is an important sense in which Maduro, whatever his weaknesses, cannot be compared to Noriega. The Panamanian strongman had effectively worked for the CIA since the 1950s, gun running for right-wing groups heavily involved in drug trade, before he fell out with Washington. He had been trained to torture at the various School of the Americas, where countless racketeers and drug trafficking money launderers had their first experience of what was required of them. The U.S. treated him extremely badly, despite everything he had done for them. He began to get one or two ideas about national sovereignty, at which the point the government of George H.W. Bush angrily decided to oust him. That operation, however, was backed by a U.S. military invasion before a joint Delta SEAL detachment lifted him from his palace and handed him over to U.S. Marshals to be locked up after a fake trial. The attacks against Maduro recall the assaults on Chavez, continually accused by the Western media of being a dictator. Why? Because he wore a uniform. But Chavez was extremely popular and won election after election. One didn't have to go down to the Gulf states and Saudi Arabia to find people infinitely worse on every level. Chavez's radical democratic constitution, including the right to recall the president by referendum if necessary, was denounced by the right-wing opposition, even though it tried to use the same recall mechanism against him. I was in Caracas when Jimmy Carter visited the country to observe elections. He was shocked when, entering a restaurant in the leafy eastern suburbs of the city, where the bourgeoisie lives, the local opposition spat abuse at him. Afterwards, he said, "I've never seen an opposition like this anywhere." He asked, "How do you think the elections went?" He answered, "He hadn't seen such a fair election in any country," clearly including the United States. Chavez always insisted that the Bolivarian revolution must be a democratic experience, and it was. Many people, including myself, discussed this with him. When the first results came in the 2004 referendum, I asked Chavez, "Compañero, what are we going to do if we lose?" He said, "What do you do if you lose? You leave office and fight from the outside, explaining why they were wrong." He had a very strong sense of this, which is why it's a travesty to accuse Chavistas of being anti-democratic from the start. During the Chavez period, the opposition newspapers and television stations blasted propaganda nonstop, attacking the regime, something you could have never seen in Britain or the United States. When people said to Chavez, we should crack down, he said, no, we should fight them politically. Since 2013, the regime had been hollowed out. If Maduro won the 2024 election, he was not able to provide any proof of it when asked by Lula. Economically, there was no doubt the Bolivarians were ill-advised, even during the Chavez days. When the best Keynesian economists turned up there, including Dean Baker and Mark Weisbrot, as well as Joseph Stiglitz, the recommendations weren't followed. Possibly it would have been better at that point if they had turned to the Chinese. But the real economic deterioration was a result of the U.S. siege. The sanctions on oil sales imposed by Trump in 2017 and 18 and maintained by Biden effectively led some 7 million people leaving the country, with Venezuelan refugees turning up in Miami, Colombia, and other parts of Latin America. Washington knew what it was doing. The support of the Venezuelan armed forces also came at a cost. After the 2002 coup attempt against Chavez, I said to him, this is your chance to go for a massive restructuring of the army. But he said, it's not easy to do. We're getting rid of all these senior generals who knew or were involved in the coup attempt against me. So I said, well, that's very generous of you. Because such a coup attempt been made against an elected official in the United States, it's very likely that the top general had been executed for treason and the other generals would have been locked up for years. But you've been very kind. You let some of these guys go out. He said, better to have the smell away. It was a weakness, I felt at the time. Yet for a long period, the Bolivarian regime combined radical democracy, far-reaching social welfare, and literacy programs in an internationalist foreign policy. That was the constellation. The Cuban contribution was very important, the Missonis and the rest of it, but the Cubans had no lessons to teach on democracy. Alas, the economic siege tightened. Caracas abandoned virtually all the Chavista reforms, turning to dollarization and austerity from 2019. On foreign policy, however, they didn't go that route. They have to cut down a lot on the oil to Cuba as a result of the U.S. sanctions, but they haven't abandoned Havana. They maintained a tough position on Gaza and the Middle East, which obviously annoys the Americans, and Washington has made clear they want a Rubio Trump government, which is theirs 100%. At stake is not only the future of Venezuela, but also that of the Cuban Revolution. The first, and alas, it would appear, last socialist revolution in the Americas. Cuba has been battered and besieged by the United States. One invasion defeated at Playa Girón, constant sanctions, constant attacks, constant lies. Without Venezuelan oil supplied free since the Bolivarians came to power, there is a reason to fear for Cuba's future. And if the U.S. succeeds in cleaning up Venezuela, Cuba may well be next. But this may prove harder than expected. The demonstrations in Caracas should serve as a warning to the Trump administration. Over the last few days, Rodriguez has been alternating between militant speeches attacking what happened and reassuring noises to the Americans. Trump is saying, we're not interested in what she says, we're interested in what she does. He's right. A lot will depend not so much on her, but just her as a figurehead. Not because she's just a figurehead, but on the Venezuelan army, which is absolutely crucial. The Trump administration could be faced with a dilemma. The Bolivarian still control the Venezuelan military and paramilitary forces, the courts, the oil industry, and every level of the administrative bureaucracy. Emotions are running high as the message delivered to the Venezuelan National Assembly by Maduro's son made clear. The Rodriguez government has been negotiating, as we know, but if Trump and Rubio ramp up the pressures too far, given the general hostility to the U.S. attack, Caracas may be forced into some show of resistance. If Rodriguez and company refuse to play ball at some point, Trump may be capable of shrugging it off, but the Rubio camp will not be. At that stage, the logic of treating Caracas as a puppet government could break down and the line will be, okay, they're traitors, let's go grab them, finally sending the boots on the ground. But that would get messy fast. It would also cause enormous tension with Trump's own camp because it was the one thing he repeatedly pledged not to do. In Chavez's 2005 speech, he went on to say, Fidel once told me, Chavez, if it ever happens to you or me, if they invade us, the last thing we'd do is what Saddam did. Go and hide on a hole. You have to die fighting in the first line of battle. And that's what I would do. If I have to die, I'll die on the front of the line with the dignity of Venezuelan, of a Venezuelan who loves his country. Nothing is settled yet. So that is the end of week one on our syllabus on American intervention in Venezuela. I hope this provided sort of a you know, general but and yet comprehensive history on just how this is a pattern of behavior and how truly it's I sometimes get frustrated when people really underscore alternative left politics, whether that be like kind of believing in socialism or believing in communism as sort of like a naive effort to be disregarded or found to be unserious. But you know who takes that incredibly seriously is right-wing governments, you know, since the Cold War. Any attempt for a country to practice or exercise democratically socialist policy is taken seriously to the full extent of the American military. They take it very seriously. They see it as a threat. And I don't think it is very productive to malign people for experimenting with what is like seen as like the only credible threat to right wing, to right wing dictatorships or people. Really, all the history of American intervention is a history of anti-communist efforts, and very interesting to see, obviously, Marco Rubio at the helm of. Of those efforts, you know, and just how unabashedly and unashamedly people like him can lie and obfuscate their own personal history for the advancement of empire, of anti-communism. It's pretty dastardly. It's probably a silly word for it, but next week we are the next week's episode is going to be called Past Analysis. We're going to be reading some Baudrillard. The Gulf War did not happen, and an essay I'm really interested to kind of dig into, which is about generally. I saw people sharing it in response to people saying, "Well, the Venezuelans seem to be happy." About Maduro being out of office. And this, you know, this essay was shared kind of in response to that about, you know, is, you know, who gets to say whether or not something is good? you know, it's about kind of like testimony and witness and all of those things. I'm really excited to read. So we'll be back next week with more on Venezuela. Stay tuned for the audio from this episode and these articles to be up on Substack, hopefully by Wednesday. That's usually my least busy day. Thank you and see you next week.